to voting by mail, and which makes it possible to do mass challenges of mail-in ballots. It also means that their votes get counted first and then create a sort of a perception of who's the actual winner. The possibility that more and more the country's developing and that Democrats mostly vote by mail and Republicans vote in person.
Well, it's bizarre world, because pre-pandemic, for black voters whom I've served, you know, we've served throughout our career and our organization's career over 60 years here, we know that black voters pre-pandemic tended to vote in person. So to the polls, for example, during early voting on a Sunday. And so the idea was that during the pandemic, there were more avenues open. So all of a sudden, when black folks, brown folks start voting by mail, all of a sudden it becomes a problem for a political party, or a problem for those who want to suppress their vote. And so, you know, every pathway to voting should be open to everyone, regardless of race, creed, or political party. That includes mail voting and absentee voting. And so, you know, the idea that one could or should discredit somehow a particular pathway to voting is absolutely ridiculous. It's almost as if they're trying to racialize somehow mail-in voting. As if it's
Damon
something,
Hewitt, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you so much for being with us. President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Election Protection Hotline is 866-OUR-VOTE if anyone has any trouble. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
A date which will live in infamy.
Tune in to KBOO on election night, Tuesday, November 8th at 6 p.m. for our live midterm election coverage. We'll have coverage that counts from local, county, state, and national races. Our anchors will be with you while the vote tallies come in, and we'll also feature analysis from your favorite KBOO hosts. That's KBOO's live midterm election coverage starting at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Don't miss it.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, election results in Oregon and Washington are expected around 8 p.m. November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month, and in international news, President Biden attempts to reset relations with Saudi Arabia. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 8th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. It's Election Day, and Oregon voters will have until 8 p.m. tonight to turn in their ballots or make sure it reaches a postal worker. Around 8 this evening, county clerks across the state will start posting their preliminary results. Last election, it took until Friday afternoon, 3 days after Election Day, for 90% of ballots to be counted. It could take longer this year, since it's the first election where voters can mail their ballots up until 8 p.m. on Election Day. Some of the high-profile, contentious, and consequential races, like that for Oregon governor and House District 5 between Jamie McLeod Skinner and Lori Chavez DeRemer, could be even further delayed thanks to a decision from the Clackamas County Clerk's Office. Clackamas County Clerk Sherry Hall announced that after the first result drop at 8 p.m. tonight, the county won't update its results again until Wednesday at 6 p.m. This is unusual. Multnomah County, for example, has committed to updates at least every 2 hours until 2 a.m. on Wednesday. But it's not illegal. Oregon Secretary of State Shamia Fagan says counties can make their own reporting schedules as long as they certify their results by December 5th, which the Clackamas County plan will do. County Clerk Sherry Hall has been under fire this year for other election mishaps that she's overseen. In the May primary election, her office sent out tens of thousands of damaged ballots that would have to be duplicated by hand. She had advanced knowledge of this, but refused help from other state and county officials for days. Results were 10 days late because of this. Both Oregon and Washington will have preliminary results around 8 p.m. tonight. So far, data shows that Washington voter turnout is lagging behind the turnout seen in 2018. Then it was 47%. Today, only 39% of Washington voters have turned in their ballots. About 36% of Oregon voters turned in their ballots by Monday. On Election Day, Clean Elections groups are speaking out to correct some common misconceptions about voting in California and across the nation. Like in Oregon, voters can mail their ballots up until 8 p.m. tonight, which means votes won't be fully counted for a few more days. Suzanne Potter has the details.
Millions of Californians already have voted, but millions more will head to the polls today to either vote in person or drop off their mail-in ballot. Groups that fight for clean elections want to clear up some myths about the ballot this year. Kim Alexander with the nonpartisan, nonprofit California Voter Foundation says some people worry, mistakenly thinking they have to vote on every race.
This is a pretty long ballot. If you don't feel comfortable making a decision on something on the ballot, you're free to skip that contest and move on to the next ballot.
As a reminder, voters must sign the ballot envelope for it to be counted. If you want to mail it, it must be postmarked today and received within 7 days. County election officials will contact voters with missing or challenged envelope signatures to give them a chance to submit a valid signature. Alexander notes that people should not expect full results tonight.
It's likely that there will be contests where you're looking at the results on election night and it may look like it's going one way, and then once all the ballots get counted, it turns out going in the other direction. And that is to be expected because what shows on election night is just a small portion of all the ballots that will be counted.
She adds that during the June primary, more than 91% of votes were cast by mail and just under half were counted within 2 days after Election Day. As of 10:40 p.m. on election night 5 months ago, only 41% of votes had been counted. Support for this reporting comes from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Election officials in Maryland are pre-processing the mail-in ballots they have received, and the results are embargoed until the polls close on Tuesday. Some call for the hand-counting of ballots, but others see machines as the best option. Brett Pivoteau reports.
With the likelihood of a long wait for election results nationwide, Maryland's decision to pre-process mail-in ballots may pay dividends in the coming days. As of last Sunday, the state reports mail-in ballot requests numbered more than 641,000. While some in the nation are calling for the hand counting of ballots, Maryland's electronic scanners machine count ballots at both the precinct and county levels. Hannah Freed is a member of the National Task Force on Election Crises. She says hand counting of ballots is prone to human error.
It's really slow and it's error prone, right? People make mistakes when they're counting a lot of ballots, right? There are better systems. Machine counting of ballots is any election expert is going to tell you that that is the time tested, battle tested way to count ballots.
Maryland's pre-processed mail-in ballot results will not be released until the polls close on Election Day. The rise in mail-in balloting in the nation has changed how quickly votes are being counted, with different states having different rules around when mail-in or absentee ballot processing can begin. Freed says we should get used to the idea that close elections may delay results.
A single county, even if it's small, if the margins are tight enough, you may see election results get delayed significantly. And I want to say it's very important to normalize that election results can take more than just election night reporting.
Following the general election, each local election board in Maryland will conduct a manual post-election tabulation audit. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Maryland News Connection, I'm Brett Pivoteau.
Election Day is here, and it's been all hands on deck for candidates on both sides of the aisle. Republicans are expected to gain a majority in the House. The fate of the Senate is uncertain, and Twitter's new CEO encourages voters to go Republican in Congress. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This election isn't a referendum, it's a choice. It's a choice between two fundamentally different visions of America.
Election Day is here, and it's been all hands on deck on both sides of the aisle to ensure the vote gets out. It's been hectic leading up to today for many politicians, including President Biden, who spoke at a campaign rally for Democratic New York Governor Kathy Hochul. It'll be a tight race, as many supporters of Republican gubernatorial candidate Lee Zeldin say they'll vote on Election Day, a trend that could be witnessed across the country as distrust in the election system grows. While Republicans are likely to maintain a majority in the House, the future of the Senate is uncertain. The battle to see who will win control of the Senate is a toss-up, with some saying it'll come down to a few battleground states like Georgia, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Nevada, and New Hampshire. First Lady Jill Biden was on the campaign trail Monday in support of Virginia Democratic Representative Jennifer Wexton, while the First Lady urged constituents to re-elect Wexton so that Democrats could continue the progress they've made since President Biden took office. Wexton was hopeful voters would vote with the same enthusiasm they did back in 2020.
It's because of you that we restored the soul of America by electing Joe Biden in 2020. It's because of you that we're going to hold on to the seat and defend our majority in Congress.
Former President Donald Trump was in Miami on Sunday, stumping for Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio. Despite speculation that former President Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis might both be vying for a presidential run in 2024, Trump expressed his support for the two Republican candidates in the Sunshine State.
The people of Florida are going to reelect the wonderful, the great friend of mine, Marco Rubio, to the United States Senate. Are you going to reelect Ron DeSantis as your governor of your state?
The results from today's elections will impact President Biden's next 2 years in office, but they will also foreshadow 2024, says elections analyst Sean Trendy.
I know we're here to talk about 2022, but we'll be talking about 2024 in 2 days.
On Monday, officials from the Department of Justice confirmed they are expanding in-person monitoring of polling locations following threats, incidents, and attempts to interfere with the election process. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says the president hopes the country's ideals are upheld at the polls.
Violence has no place in our democracy. He will continue to condemn violence, as you've heard him say, as you've heard me say from this very podium. He believes other leaders of both parties have a responsibility to communicate just that.
Finally, Twitter's new owner Elon Musk tweeted Monday that independent-minded voters should choose a Republican Congress given the presidency is Democratic, and later clarified that his historical party affiliation had always been independent, with a voting history consisting entirely of Democrats until now. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our HRS indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a rebroadcast of our interview with Sterling Cuneo, one of the advocates behind Measure 112 on the Oregon ballot, which would remove slavery as a punishment for a crime from the state constitution. We'll follow that up with a look back at Ray Bodwell's thoughts from throughout our election coverage. Stick around at 6, it's KBOO's live election night broadcast, hosted by Annette Newell, Yvonne Rivero, and Michelle Coppola. We'll be tracking national, state, and local results in real time and speaking with some of your favorite KBOO hosts. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 36. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny but cold and a high of 49. Today in history, in 1892, the New Orleans General Strike begins, uniting black and white American trade unionists in a successful four-day general strike action for the first time. The quote of the day is from Canadian-American game show host Alex Trebek, the longtime host of Jeopardy, who died today in 2020. Trebek said, quote, "Be kinder to each other. I see America in a crisis situation right now in so many ways, and I want people to open up their hearts and open up their hands and open up their wallets to help each other. Because if ever there was a time when we needed to do that, that time is now." Oklahoma is poised to make congressional history, potentially sending three Native American representatives to Congress. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Election Day is here. Oklahoma is poised to make history with the likelihood of three Native Americans expected to serve in Congress. Incumbent Representative Tom Cole is heavily favored to be reelected to his seat. Mark Wayne Mullen is giving up his House seat and is leading in the race for U.S. Senate. Josh Burkeen is expected to win the race to fill Mullen's seat. All are Republicans and enrolled in Oklahoma tribes. One incumbent in Oklahoma faces a stiff challenge for re-election. Governor Kevin Stitt is a Republican and a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, but he's been at odds with the state's tribes since early in his first term. The Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Seminole, and Muskogee Nations are among the tribes that have thrown their support to his Democratic opponent. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. calls the governor's race the most important in the state's history. Among things Stitt has clashed with tribes over gaming compacts, he's also a aggressively pursued legal actions to limit tribal jurisdiction. At least 10 Native candidates are vying for congressional seats in the midterms, and many more are on the ballots in local and state races. Two Native congressional incumbents are in tight races following redistricting. Pre-election polling shows New Mexico Republican Representative Yvette Harrell in a close race with her Democratic opponent. Harrell is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Meanwhile, Kansas Democrat Sharice Davids, who was among the first two Native women elected to the House of Representatives in 2018, is facing strong competition from her Republican challenger. Davids is a citizen of the Ho-Chunk Nation. And in Alaska, Representative Mary Peltola has been campaigning to keep her seat. Peltola made history in September, becoming the first Alaska Native person, Yupik, to ever serve in Congress. She won the late Republican Congressman Don Young's seat in a special election. The Democrat has broad support from Alaska Native communities. In an interview with the National Native News in October, Peltola discussed serving Alaska Native and American Indian people, but also all people.
It's a serious job. And I don't see this as a stepping stone to anything else. I don't see this as a springboard to anything else. I really just very literally take this job for face value. I want to work hard for Alaskans.
Peltola has been endorsed by the Alaska Federation of Natives, the largest statewide Native organization in Alaska. The race for top leader of one of the largest tribes in the United States, the Navajo Nation, is underway. Current President Jonathan Nez is facing challenger Boone Igrin. The tribe, which has the largest reservation in the U.S., located in the Four Corners region, was hit hard by COVID-19. Nez has led the tribe through the pandemic, issuing a number of emergency measures. Dropping mandates and fully reopening the Navajo Nation are issues the candidates disagree on. Nez says the tribe needs to continue to be cautious with COVID-19 and now with monkeypox.
We are utilizing those lessons learned from COVID-19. And right now we're just monitoring the situation. And, you know, I think eventually the government's going to have to step back, because the government has taught everyone what to do and what not to do.
Nygren says the Navajo Nation is ready to fully reopen and move forward from the pandemic.
The Navajo Nation, we've continued to stifle our communities, scare our people. And since I made my announcement on April 4th, being the first person to announce for president, I said it's about time we reopen 100%.
As Navajo voters head to the polls, both say they're focused on working hard for Navajo people to improve infrastructure, create jobs, and address social issues. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
It's Lung Cancer Awareness Month, raising awareness for a disease that is estimated to kill 130,000 people in the United States this year. Eric Tegedoff has more on the importance of increasing awareness of the disease.
November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month, bringing the spotlight to the country's deadliest form of cancer. There will be an estimated 130,000 lung cancer deaths in 2022, including more than 8,400 in Oregon, according to the American Cancer Society. Michael Skokin is a pulmonary critical care physician at the Oregon Clinic. He says many of these deaths are preventable, and the first action people can take is to stop smoking. Skokin says the disease historically has presented some challenges to doctors.
When you find it at an early stage, you can treat it. But over the years, we hadn't been good at doing that because people don't really have symptoms. And once they have symptoms, it's usually a later stage and it's spread and it's much, much more difficult to treat. And sometimes it's not treatable.
Skokin says people who haven't yet quit and meet certain criteria are able to get screened for the cancer with a CT scan of their lungs. The scan helps doctors identify early-stage lung cancers, and the tool has been around for about a decade. COVID-19 has an effect on lung health, but no direct link with cancer. However, Skokin says the pandemic did affect treatment, with many people avoiding the doctor's office.
People who got other things during that time when everything was really problematic in getting care, that affected a lot of people who didn't necessarily have COVID, but got other things, including lung disease or lung cancer, and couldn't get treated as timely as we had been able to do in the past.
While the number of deaths are still high, Skokin notes that they have been going down in recent years for a few reasons.
Number one, less people smoking. So we're starting to see the effects of that. And the other thing is that our treatments are getting better. So people who present with lung cancer, we now have more options for treatment and people are living longer.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Regenerative agriculture is one way farmers could make their businesses more climate friendly. But as much as this is sustainable for the environment, is it financially sustainable? Edwin J. Vieira has more in Virginia.
Virginia farmers looking for a sustainable way to tend to their crops can look at regenerative agriculture for this purpose. The idea of regenerative agriculture is to focus on soil health and the carbon sequestration of the land. It improves the soil quality without artificially fertilizing it. Steve Normanton owns Normanton Farms. He utilizes this practice and finds it has numerous benefits, one of which is keeping plants healthy for consumption.
You are what you eat, right? And so what you want to be putting into your body is the healthiest possible food that you possibly can. You're looking at that and you're thinking about regenerative agriculture. It's all about creating healthy soil.
He adds that another way it's sustainable for farming is that the soil's health makes for better crops, since it's not reliant on pesticides. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, agriculture accounted for about 11% of climate change in 2020. Despite the benefits of regenerative agriculture, farms still have to go with a method that keeps their business afloat. But Latana Obadozi with the National Young Farmers Coalition finds making a profit and doing regenerative agriculture doesn't have to be an either-or situation.
I think that even though there isn't the explicit focus on like pure yield and farm size, like this still is a very profitable method of farming. But again, because regenerative agriculture takes a more holistic approach to farming, the sole focus isn't just profit.
Some of the long-term benefits of regenerative agriculture include better water retention, better ability to hold nutrients, and reduced soil erosion. She adds that one large point of this method of farming is the focus on keeping land healthy for generations to come. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, Virginia News Connection.
Biden promised to reset relations with Saudi Arabia, but after his most recent visit and OPEC's surprise cut to oil production, it seems the two powers are not on the same course. Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Let's talk about Saudi Arabia, which, along with the rest of OPEC, has decided to cut oil production by 2 million barrels a day. President Biden is miffed and has signaled that he's fed up with the Saudis, who, according to a New York Times report, duped the administration into believing OPEC would not be cutting oil production and, in fact, would significantly increase it. Assuming the episode amounts to Saudi duplicity and Russian influence, as opposed to an honest Saudi cost-benefit calculation on oil pricing, the question is, what will Biden do about relations with Saudi Arabia? Let's look at the balance sheet on U.S.-Saudi relations. Supporters of the partnership argue that Saudi Arabia offers U.S. military access, is a major weapons buyer, shares hostility to Iran, is tolerant of Israel, and of course has all that oil. On the negative side, it's a serial human rights violator, home to most of the 9/11 terrorists, purchaser of Russian oil that helps fund Putin's war machine, war crimes candidate in its Yemen intervention, an unreliable partner when called upon for support. And there's the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi on orders from Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, popularly known as MBS. He will lie to Americans whenever it suits him, confident that his decisions on oil production and pricing will always keep them in line. And for decades, he and other Saudi leaders have been right. Cheap oil and the Iran enemy have always trumped human rights and other supposed American priorities. Joe Biden is the latest U.S. president to be hoodwinked by the Saudis. He entered office seemingly determined to recalibrate the U.S.-Saudi relationship. The Khashoggi murder and the humanitarian disaster in Yemen were getting a bad press and faced rising anger in liberal quarters of Congress. Biden vowed the Saudis would, quote, pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah they are. Yet by the time Biden made his first trip to the Middle East in July, he was backtracking. In an op-ed for the Washington Post prior to his trip, Biden said, "From the start, my aim was to reorient but not rupture relations with a country that's been a strategic partner for 80 years. Thus, the infamous fist bump with MBS and the message, intended or not, that all is forgiven." The head of the U.S. Central Command for the Middle East chimed in, saying of military ties with Saudi Arabia, quote, "The kingdom is poised for the future, and I look forward to a continued military partnership." That was a bad idea then, and it's an even worse idea now. But remember this, MBS never promised Biden that the Saudis would increase oil production, a major goal of Biden's trip. The trip was a win for MBS, who gave up nothing in return for American renewal of a partnership that has resulted in billions of dollars in U.S. military aid to Saudi Arabia, as well as over $100 billion in weapons sales contracts. What should be happening is termination of U.S. military ties with Saudi Arabia. The direct assistance, the supporting role in its Yemen intervention, the soldiers on the ground, the U.S. bases, and, as the Washington Post has just revealed, the retired senior U.S. military officers who serve as well-paid advisors to the Saudi Defense Ministry. That last practice is not new. Recall General Michael Flynn's work for Turkey. With the Saudis, it's generals like James L. Jones, President Obama's national security advisor, who recruited four other retired generals and William S. Cohen, the former defense secretary, as part of a team set up by Jones in his consulting firm. Similarly, with the Saudis' partner in Yemen, the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, another absolute monarchy that not only is a major customer for U.S. arms and provides a base for U.S. air and naval forces, the UAE also counts on advice from retired generals like James Mattis, Trump's former defense secretary. These advisors, by the way, can only serve upon approval of the State Department and the Pentagon, which turn out to be very reluctant to report it and quick to defend the practice. That should tell you how obliging administrations are, even when they know full well that retired military officers are supporting reprehensible regimes that now are playing ball with Russia on oil prices. It's only a thanks to a lawsuit by the Washington Post that we know about this revolving door. In short, the U.S. military relationship with Saudi Arabia, now under scrutiny in Congress, is a classic case of the military-industrial complex's influence on Middle East policy. Fact is, military ties are the only basis for relations with the Saudis. That regime has made clear that Russia and China are equally important partners. One congressional critic said, "What galls many of us in Congress is the ingratitude." Galling? How about this for gall? MBS recently asked the U.S. for help when his intelligence reported an Iranian threat of attack. But well beyond gall is our own gullibility and accepting Saudi excuses and lies. Ending military ties with the MBS regime is long overdue. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 8th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Alex Gonzalez, Brett Pivoteau, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News.